if you want, but it's really it's crap because I have it broken out so you can see all the different layers as opposed to condensing it so you can have n number of layers. And you know what I'm talking about.
Are you will.
Okay. So I'm going to go a little bit into the biology stuff. Sorry about that. Just to cover my particular problem set and what a neural net is. And then we're going to go into the basics of the neural net. Really quick math. It's all plus and minuses. There's some matrix stuff in here, but I'm going to gloss over it really fast. Yeah.
Can you say where you work?
Oh, sorry. This one I've actually been doing on my own for gosh, since 1996, really. I work for the Software Engineering Institute during the day, and I actually work on supporting a certain Army program that's about to get snipped into three pieces.
So where, how is SEI?
Software Engineering Institute is out of Carnegie Mellon University. It's a federally funded research agency. This is a setup doing on my own, of course. But for them, I support the Army Future Combat System. You guys know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. They call us in.
They killed it.
Yeah, sort of.
But they killed a couple pieces of it or something, right?
They're going to break it into three parts, and they're killing the vehicles is a rumor, but there's no acquisition decision memorandum to settle it. So if they call us in, it's like one Texas Ranger per riot? Same kind of idea, except there's two of us. Mm-hmm. One guy Huntington Beach and me. And then we go in there and go, okay, here's what you should have done, and here's what we advise that you do now. So that's what I do. I restructure their software at this stage of the game and help them with some process stuff too, but this stage a little bit of software architecture. So that's what I do. But that's my day job.
So are you doing this for a real world project or for hobby learning?
This I'm doing because I want to try to find, I have my personal theory is that there are certain interfering microRNAs that have yet to be uncovered in certain uncoding sections of DNA that affect a couple diseases, acute myeloid leukemia, Alzheimer's, and what was the other disease I was looking at? I had a third disease. Them are the two big ones, and them are the two segments that I've been primarily targeting. And honestly, I'm going to tell you, it's been a hard row to hoe. So my particular problem set has turned out to be much more difficult than I ever thought it would be, which is not overly surprising since I'm stepping out into the open realm. And what neural nets are really good at is finding patterns. Well, if it turns out that there's not that good of a pattern in the data, then your error set is huge. So that's sort of the problem I'm at right now, is I've hit a point where I can make the neural net as big as I want, and it's not going to really get a whole lot better at finding the pattern. But that's okay, that told me something. So, you know, I have my next steps will be to chop the code up a little bit differently and use some other method and then maybe feed that to the neural net. Good to go?
Yep. Thanks.
No problem at all? I just don't want to bore anybody with that kind of stuff. Okay, if I had bothered to turn on the wireless, I could have linked the links are in here. So microRNAs are little teeny pieces of DNA. Are teeny pieces of RNA coded from DNA. So inside your DNA, you have a bunch of empty areas. Otherwise, it used to be called genetic junk. Well, we found out that's not really junk. There's actually things that happen in there. And so it'll code through the DNA, pull off this microRNA after it does a couple operations. And that microRNA can turn things on or off inside the real important part of the genetic code. So that's why I've targeted it, because it's usually the microRNAs themselves are really small. They're only like 20 bases. So A, T, G, C, right? Mm-hmm. The four big bases of DNA. They're only 20 long. So you can't really look for those. I found that one out the hard way. And the reason is because the enzymes do some slicing and dicing a little differently. So when I started, they didn't know this, and I got about a little way into it, and then they found this out. I'm like, well, great, thanks for telling me now. So the enzymes chop up the DNA and reset it to make the microRNA. So the good thing is that they come from a thing called a hairpin or a precursor. And the hairpin is much larger, and it actually has everything in it that says this is a microRNA. So that's the really important part. In fact, what happens is the So, as we know, A complements to G, or T, G complements to C, right? What will happen is on our DNA, so your DNA will be like this. It'll get coded out by complementing the A's and A and T's and G's and C's, messenger RNA, which would be another long strand of, you know, A, T, G, you get the idea, all the way along here. Well, what will happen is once it codes this big strand of RNA, some parts of it will self-complement to make this hairpin thing. Looks like that. That's so some of it will go and stick to itself.
That's in the structure of the RNA.
That's in the structure of the RNA after it comes off your DNA, or any DNA. And then what will happen is this enzyme will come along, and first it will chop this loop. It'll go snip the loop off. Another one will come in and chop out the thing that will become the microRNA. And this is the part that, because I had assumed that the sequence would be in the hairpin loop. Mm-mm. Not exactly right. What it'll do is it'll chop a segment out that will have it in there, and another enzyme chops out the intervening pieces to make the microRNA. Three chunks of enzymes involved, right? As far as my neural net's concerned, I need a good pattern to look for. Since it's not actually in here, I can't use that. So what I need to do is, these hairpins are also known and cataloged. And so these are like 180, whatever it says up there. 189 or 143, so some of them are on this side. If the mRNA is, if the microRNA is on this side, then it's 143 bases for this whole hairpin. And if it's on this side, it's 189. So that tells me that this hairpin is somewhere between 143 and 189, plus or minus. For my purposes, I'll assume it's really small, down to 80, and as big as 200. Make sense? Actually, 300 in my case. I didn't want to take any chances. So, and if you're curious about where miRNAs, microRNAs occur, here's the different chromosomes of your body they occur at. This one should be interesting to those of a male or female gender, since this is the sex chromosome. So a lot of them occur on the X chromosome, tons of them. None on the Y's. So if you have two X chromosomes, it'll cover for some of these. So if this accidentally shuts something off, the other one will cover for it, so you're more genetically blessed than the rest of us. The rest of us have to deal with whatever happens to be on that chromosome. So, good to know. That gives you an idea of what my problem set is. So my idea was to come up with a learning program, in this case a neural net, that will sit there and zip its way along the DNA and scan for those hairpins. And in my case, not just scan for existing ones, because that's just a search, right? No, I want to scan for ones that don't necessarily exist yet, but fit the pattern of being an RNA, microRNA hairpin. So that's what a neural net does. It will look for things that are not in the center. It'll look for the pattern that you and I and every other person on the planet can't see, but that the code hopefully will find inside the data itself. That's what neural nets do.
So what do you use for data? You use signal strand or some sort of...
I'll show you. That's exactly what I do. So I'm going to use this to scan down DNA. And you can get the DNA from the Ensemble database, or you can go out to NCBI BLAST. And I have a whole series of references in here in the thing that you can get it from. And you can download the actual string, and then I deal with it from there. So if I find one, it takes it, tosses it in a bin, and then tells me, hey, I found something. In my case, you have to do a couple things before you get that far. So first you have to obtain the DNA for the hairpins. Well, I got that from the Sanger Amir base, and it's on that link on the first page. So the folks at Sanger in UK just happen to categorize every microRNA that exists. And the number I have in here is from 2006, because since I haven't got past the training stage, you know, I didn't want to download a whole other data set to play with. But that's probably expanded by at least 30 or 40% since then, since this is a hot area of research right now. Anyhow, so I'm going to go past that. I'm going to decide how I'm going to take that DNA and turn it into something the neural net can understand, and I'll explain why. You develop an XML schema, which is XML is how I'm storing the data. So all my matrices, all my data files are largely XML, so I can just look at them and read them. Now, that's if for those of you who know XML, and that's probably this whole group, you realize it's very cumbersome too. So that's the risk you take when you do this. So I preferably only pull the data in once, operate on it, and at the very end of the program, maybe kick out the, you know, the breakpoints, you know, whenever I have to, because it takes so long to manipulate the data files. Okay, so what I want to do is make the neural net and train it to 5 nines. And I'll tell you why I want to go that far, because DNA is really, really big. If I fail and find a new DNA pattern and redo, etc., send the answers when I find anything. If I ever find anything, I'll send it to some of the key researchers in the field and let them confirm what I find. The upside is, with the neural net or whatever method you decide to do, there is so much genetic research that anyone in this room can do it. And that's probably what you heard from the bioinformatics guy, if I remember last time. Is there's so many data patterns out there, text parsable patterns, and it's all text, that any strategy you have might find something. In fact, there are companies that people started up just to do that. You know, basic text manipulation. Here's what a neural net is. So inside your head is a neural net. In fact, inside your eyeball is a neural net. So the part of your eye that converts the image you see in your eyeball, in your retina, and converts that for the optic nerve to read is actually a neural net unto itself, and it's smarter than a lot of flatworms. Just thought that would be a cute one, but... So I'm copying a pattern that exists in nature. For my purposes, of course, I have to computerize something that's far less complicated than the real thing. There's a book out there that's written by a guy named Haken, and the one I have is from 1994. I don't know if he did a new version since then, because it's an expensive textbook, and I feel like buying it. You can look up online. There's a bazillion resources out there for neural nets. So if anybody's a neural net expert in here, I abuse the terminology heavily, so please don't kill me. But anyhow, it's a good book if you really want to get into this. It's a really good book on it. What are neural networks? And I actually drew something up here, sort of like one right there. So the way it works computationally, and this is how it actually works in a real neuron, is you have a bunch of different things that stick out from the neuron that allow inputs to come in, right? What are they, dendrites? If I remember right, dendrites?
Dendrites,
yeah. They come into the neuron. And computationally, what I'll do is I'll add all these together after multiplying a thing called weights against them. So each one of these inputs has a weight I multiply it against. So some of these I want to listen to more than others. And I train my neural net to figure out which ones I need to listen to more than others. Then what I do is once I weight them all, so I take each input, multiply it by its weight, and then add them all together or sum them inside the neuron. That simple. I just add them all together after I multiply each input by a weight. Then I use some kind of an activation function that says, hey, if it gets to a certain threshold, I'm activated. I spit out a positive one saying, hey, I'm activated. If it doesn't hit that threshold, it just stays negative. Right, so it's either negative one or positive one under most cases. I have a trick for going around that, actually, because I have a state of zero in mind. And that's not unprecedented in neural nets either. There are some that do that. So the thing to remember is my inputs have to either be preferably plus one, minus one, or in my case, a zero. So no matter what you use a neural net for, you have to take your input data and make it look preferably like these two. Plus ones or minus ones, no matter what it is. If it's an image, same thing. So I might decide to take all the bits of a color and assign the zeros, minus ones, and the ones, plus ones. And that's how a lot of image neural nets work. A lot of facial recognition software, that's a neural net, by the way. Perfect example. Or character recognition, neural net. Same thing. So this is the big trick. It's called input encoding. You have to store your weights matrices, and then you make decisions on how many of these you want and how many different layers of them, because this output could go into another neuron. In fact, it might go into a whole other series of neurons. And then the decision is, after you're done with all this, how are you going to crunch it down to what you want? In my case, it's a yes or no answer. But you might want to stop it before here somewhere and say, hey, I want I want some number that I can feed into a case statement. So that's sort of the gist of how it works. It's really good at finding patterns if they exist. So we'll get into here's a perfect example of one that only has a total of 3 neurons. You have 2 neurons here in one layer, 1 and 2. I'm going to call that an input layer. I have 1 neuron over here that's my output layer, and because I'm after either a 1 or no answer, yes or no, a +1 or a -1. So this is just an example. This isn't the one I'm using. It's a low-level example so we can get the idea of what's going on here. So I started off, anything that comes out here gets multiplied by something in the weights matrix. So this one here gets multiplied by this one if it's going into this neuron. And then I sum all those together, and it'll go into the output, and we got a little more detail on that. And then my threshold I'm using is a thing called an activation response function, is a sign. So if it's negative, it says, okay, it's now -1. If it's positive, it's now +1. You can also use other things like tangents and whatever floats your boat. Whatever way you want to play with it. There's a big equation up here. Actually, I didn't put it in here. There's an equation you can use where you can multiply what comes in also. Just multiply everything to amplify what comes in. And we'll get to that a little later, too. So we're going to start with this thing. So we take the first round of input matrices, and don't worry about how I got to ones and -1 and +1. And as you can see, I'm going across the top of this matrix here, these weights. And this -1 gets multiplied by that. +1 gets multiplied by that. -1 by that. -1 by that. Goes into the first neuron whose result is -1. And if you want to see all the math that got you there, there it is. So that's what happens in the first neuron. There's nothing really magical about this, by the way, if you haven't noticed. Same thing in the second neuron. I do the same thing. And I'm going to tell you something. Before I apply the activation function, that sign, I'm going to store that result because I might need it when I train it later. So the first thing I'm doing with my neural net is I'm running this through to say, hey, I get a +/- result. Next thing I'm going to do is say, hey, you were wrong. I'm going to wrap your knuckles. So it goes through that first layer, and then all I do is take that outputs of the first layer and send it into the second layer with that little 0.5 weights matrix up above there. Thing to note about my weight matrices here and everywhere else, they all add up to 1. And that's a big thing you need to remember about a neural net. You really want your weight matrices to add up to 1. So what you'll do is if it comes out to any other number after you train it, you'll normalize it to force it back to 1. Goes into my output to -1. My decision out of the neural net is no for whatever that input was. Now, if that was not my correct response, so no was not what I really wanted a yes, then I have to train the neural net, and by training it, I change these weight matrices. So that's how you do it. So really, if you want to look at the one file that you need to save out of your neural net before you do anything else, the one file you don't want to lose, it's the weights matrices, because it is really what defines your neural net. That is how the learning occurs, and that's how it stores knowledge, is in the weights matrices. You see some really fancy equations along here? What this does is it says, hey, I'm going to change the weights by this amount. I want to multiply. This tells me how much I'm going to train by. So how hard am I wrapping the knuckles of my neural net? So if this is a big number, then I'm wrapping them with a steel pipe. If it's a small number, I'm wrapping them with a feather. And then my neural net will learn accordingly. If I wrap it too hard, it might never learn because it's unstable. If I wrap it too soft, it might never learn either because it'll take too long. Not enough pain to induce the right response. So that's what these fancy equations do. So remember I told you I saved everything before I applied the activation function in each layer?
Question back here.
Yeah.
Feedback to the top level net or to the second level net?
Both.
Oh.
You feed back to every layer if you can. Now, it might not change the weights as a result, but I default to doing it that way. And the reason is because I might have missed something and it might actually found something that makes it want to change.
So you're basically telling...
I train both weights matrices.
Okay. And you're telling them that their answer was wrong and that it was wrong by a certain amount and then they adjust the
exactly.
multipliers.
Just like that. Very perceptive. That's exactly the way it works. It's that simple. So if you want to follow the fun math, I did a whole bunch of the fun math where I multiply everything back out by that Y thing I saved for you, and then by how much wrong it was, and by some additive multiplier that I added on, because additive multipliers are always safer than multiplicative multipliers. So in that, instead of using the V, I just use this one right here. So that one doesn't multiply, it hits it only with an exact amount no matter how wrong it is. So as a result, I go back through, I change the weights, and since what I wanted was a plus one, remember that was what I wanted it to tell me when I put in this input data, then if you notice, it changed the weights matrices to favor those two plus ones right here in the middle. That's all the magic there is to it. That's exactly how every neural net out there works. It's that simple.
And that's how biology works, too. Right?
Much more complicated than
well,
that.
But that's essentially what it's doing.
That's essentially what a neuron does.
Yeah.
In fact, a lot of these, everything that you see, every coefficient in there has an analog.
Right.
In real life. In real neurons. So my former professor over at UMSL, who I had at one time, Dr. Lon Wilkins, he's a paddlefish. He's a master of paddlefish. Anything you ever wanted to know about how paddlefish noses work, he knows. And the reason he does is because he mapped all their neurons inside their head.
Wow.
And so there he found it. He has biological analogs for every one of these. So there's like a little cell that wraps around the ganglia that acts as a multiplier. There's some other chemicals that act as additives, alcohol or caffeine, depending upon whether you want to go up or down.
Okay.
There's biological analogs for everything in here. Yeah, so if you want to make some wild artificial intelligence, this might be a first step for anybody who decides to head that direction. The process, my case, so if you actually want to do something with your neural net, first you have to decide what you're going to do with your data, I told you that. The next thing is you have to get what has the pattern. So what data that you have that has the pattern you want to find. In my case, I went to Sanger and downloaded all the hairpins for all the microRNAs, but in your case, it could be, if I want to map every letter in the alphabet, it would be a bitmap of every letter in the alphabet. The next thing is you need to do to make fake data. The way you usually make fake data, that's probably the easiest way to make sure you're not, just if you have a data set that's hard to duplicate randomly, you just make random data, in my case, a variable random size. And you make at least two times as many of those as you have of truth. And that way you have more fakes than reals, at least two times. You might want more than that. So it depends on how much noise you think you're going to expect. So that's how you make your fake data. You just get a random number generator and start cooking. Make gobbledygook fake BS that looks about the same size as the truth. Decide the neural net structure and assumptions. So this particular neural net, I'm going to make an assumption of I'm going to encode my DNA a certain way. I'm going to make A's, plus one, minus one, and T's plus one, and, like that. In fact, if we go all the way to the backup slides, I'll show you exactly how I did it. Yeah, almost there. Right there. Just like this. Actually, no, that's not it. Sorry. I think I actually have it in here. Sorry. My bad. That's what I get for being disorganized. Oh, I have it in here. Okay, sorry. Anyhow, I'm going to tell you how I'm going to make the input data. So, you get your truth data, fake data, you decide how you want to structure your neural net. How many neurons per layer? That's a big assumption. How many layers? So the more complex the data is, the more layers you might want to look at, but the danger of that is it takes exponentially longer to train. So if you can get away with a one-layer neural net, That's the first thing you start with. Before you do anything else, just add nodes to that until you see if you find what you're after. If that doesn't work, then you start playing with more layers. So word from bad experience. That's just the way it happens to work. The other thing you might want to decide is, do I want to end up at a plus one or minus one, or do I want to end up at some category of numbers? You know, a sequence of bits that I want to map against something of the case statement. And then I make my input encoder to turn whatever I'm looking at into plus ones, minus ones, and in some cases zeros. Code the neural net forward pass and backward pass. So the forward pass is that part that went forward through the thing and came up with a result. The backward pass was the thing that trained the weights matrices. Create your trainer, save the weights, use your neural net in whatever you decide to make. If you're slick, what you'll do is you'll take that forward pass and then backward pass and put it in like a module or something that you can reuse everywhere. So you're using the same modules for real use and for training. Same thing in here. It says the same thing in here. Training is the longest part run-wise, is the big point I want out of this. And the one I started with and the one that's about what I have now is about this thick. So here's sort of what the real one looks like compared to that trivial one we looked at earlier. So I've got my DNA sequence. So, and I get it from the Sanger guys. I encode that using this subroutine into plus ones, minus ones, in my case zeros, to pack anywhere that has no data. Because what I want is my input array has to be of a fixed size or else it's really hard to train. I decided that I wanted 300 bits wide, so I have to encode everything into 300 bits, 300 plus ones, minus ones.
I'm sorry, did you answer while I was on the phone how you encode multiple DNA encodings into plus one, minus one?
Something like that? Yeah, I have a section on it here. I haven't got to it yet.
Okay.
Part I wanted to go to is if any of you deciding to do any other problem set, I'm generalizing a little bit here, you might want to do an image, and here's an example of how you take an image and turn it into the same thing. Before I go into the DNA part, so I can take some image, convert it into a certain bitmap, plus ones, minus ones, in this case for the black part, and put it into a big input array, just like that. That's all you do for input encoding. And I already talked about what parts I need. Input encoder, here's how I do it right there. In fact, here's the subroutine to do it. So what I do is I use a little couple Perl tricks in here because I can. And I take A's and substitute them for 0, 0's, T's for 1, 1's, C for 1, 0, G for 0, 1, and then swap all the 0's for minus 1's using a split. Can you see it right here? Or is it split? Yeah, you use split. So I split on I split for every character and then substitute 0's for 1's. Minus 1's, right here. And that's how I input all that, that's how I encode the DNA. It's that simple. So I took all the sequences, all the ones from Sanger, just put them in a big XML file, and it feeds straight into the subroutine. And that's how it preps it to go into the neural net. So as I said, it's not big magic here. It's very simple. And the temp array is the one that has that whole DNA in it. Here's the graphical form, which might be easier to understand. So every T goes to a 1, 1, ends up as a plus 1, plus 1 over here. And since that set over there is smaller than my input array, everywhere that's not input, this is a decision I made, by the way, was to put zeros in the other areas. That way it's not influencing my neural net for blank space. So if I graph, since I have a variable input size, I don't know how big the input's going to be, and I had to decide on how big my input array was, I just packed everything else with zeros. The other thing I did is I centered it in the middle so that it's always starting from the same, it's always looking for the same fat part of the pattern. That was another decision I made in this case. So back when I said make your assumptions and decisions, these were two of mine. You could have done it totally different. I could have packed the empty space with minus ones, you know, and gone that way. But I had a fear that would alter the results in a bad direction. It would cause it to only look for neural nets of a certain size. for inputs of a certain size, and that's not helping me any. So this is a decision I made. So that's how I turn the sequence into plus ones and minus ones. As I said, it's very simple. That part's very simple. So my case, I told you I had two sets of I have two primary neurons, and I call it NI and NJ. And then for every neural net array, there's weights that feed the inputs into the neural net. Those weights are stored here in WI and WJ. And it's a matrices. You really don't have to know much about matrices to do this, because it's really just a series of for loops, or do loops if you'd like to code in another language. Looks like that. Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah, I'm not even I should be in presentation mode here, shouldn't I? There we go. Sorry. That's what I get for using my work laptop. You know, it never lets me go on anything. Like so. I realize it's really small text. So the ones I wanted you to point out in this whole pile, and it's not optimal Perl code, by the way, so as I said, if you copy it, you might want to look for anything I screwed up in. Because this is an older section, and I sort of copied it and tried to take out all the things that weren't pertinent to the example. So if I accidentally took out something important, it might not run if you copy it directly. So look at it and make sure. And as I said, I'll put up a better example on our web if you want to try to play with them on your own. Center fill. So I told you I centered it, and I filled in all the zeros. But I left them as options in my code in case I changed my mind. And so, as I said, it goes through that sequence that you saw. This array bin thing, or is it? Oh, here, it's bin convert. So it converts it all into the plus ones and minus ones. And then why did I do this?
What's my train of thought here? Oh, and this does all that. So you use that subroutine to encode it. And then this also fills it with zeros and pads the zeros and centers it. So I use the bin convert to convert all the A's and T's to one zeros and then plus one minus one. And then this centers it inside my input array. So it takes whatever variable size it was and makes sure it packs it in. That's all this whole sequence does.
So then I do a forward pass. So as I said, I have the input array, the first neuron it hits, the first array of neurons, and then the weights that go with those.
So let's go to the next thing.
So here you're looking for this in the loops, and only in the loops.
I'm starting off just looking at the loops because I have to train my neural net. I can't scan the real DNA until I know I have something that actually knows what it's looking for. That's the trick.
Your purpose then is to come up with a series of patterns that occur frequently in a particular situation.
Well, the purpose is to take the neural net and train it so that it can spot the patterns. Because I'm not going to be able to, the pattern won't mean it. The patterns are stored in the weights and I won't mean a thing to me. Right? That's the thing. A neural net is a dispassionate pattern analyzer. So it will look for patterns, and if it has a pattern, then you store that in the weights. And then my idea was to take, once I had those weights that are trained, to use the same forward pass module to start scanning human DNA.
For a microRNA
hairpins, like so. Exactly what I trained it on. So you train the neural net to look for certain things, and then you use the neural net to find those things. In my case, I train it for the hairpins, and then I'm going to use it to find those hairpins in real DNA.
Thing to note about all this funky Perl magic, that's all you're doing is a series of nested loops for each neural net. So for each layer, each neuron, I have to add up all of its inputs and multiply it by weight, which I do here. So weight times the input. And then I add it up for each neuron in the array. And then I store that here. And that gives me the values for each one of those. So that's my values before I apply the activation function. So it's just adding up all those inputs in that nested loop. And that's that raw response. So
I also use an additive multiplier on it to amplify what I'm getting. So instead of just taking the weights and the inputs, I want to add an amp. I want to add an amplifier for my purposes to help it see the pattern. So all you're doing is amplifying the signal, right? It's exactly what your stereo amplifier does. If you feed this stereo amplifier garbage, you get garbage out. It just amplifies more noise, right? More crackle. You know, but if you feed it good stuff, then it amplifies the good stuff. That's what it's doing, exactly like a stereo amplifier. So, and then I apply the activation function, which is that sine thing. So if it's positive, it's now positive 1. If it's negative, it's now negative 1. And I do that right here. And that's the whole first layer. That's exactly the code that runs the entire first layer. You saw it. It's right there. The next thing I do is the same thing for the rest of the layers. So I had that first layer that took the input took the input from my input parser. First neural net layer. This covers the second one and that one neuron at the end that turns it into plus 1 or minus 1 for the whole result. But it takes all this input and gets me a plus 1 or minus 1 for my trouble.
And it uses plus 1 and minus 1 as decision making?
Okay, correct.
Does this match? Does it not match?
And I'm going to talk about how I trained it here in a couple slides. So I just wanted everybody to get used to the idea that I'm doing some looping to do the magic of the matrix multiplication, which means you don't have to know really what a matrix is if you really don't want to dig into it. All you have to do is know that. So you're all you're doing is adding up all the inputs. You know, at input multiplied by weight, in my case adding an amplifier, adding all those up, that's in one neuron, and then I'm going to use that. So I do that for each layer, and it's the same code that's there. And if you notice, I end up with the impulse out of each one. So I end up with a plus one or minus one right here. And at the very end, and this is the last one, it comes up with just a plus one or minus one stored right there in the action impulse. That's it. So that's the output of all my inputs that are in there. Either comes up with a plus one or minus one in my case. This is called a classification neural net, by the way. So I'm classifying it as either a one or plus one or minus one. So that's the result of all that work. Next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, well, this input data that I fed in here, what it should have been was either a plus one or a minus one, right? So I'm going to say if it was a plus one, then I have to compare that against what I got over here, just like we did in the example. So if it was a truth item, if it was a real microRNA hairpin, then it should be a plus one out of this whole neural net. If it's any of those random fake data that I fed it, then it's a minus one. So it compares that against what it should have expected, the correct action response. Okay. So what I did is when I stored my data, when I stored my input data, and I actually stored two separate files. So I have one file of truth data, and it knows if it comes out of that truth data file, that XML, that everything in there gets a plus, everything in there's truth value is a plus one. That's what it is. It's the real thing. If it came out of my fake file, it knows it's a negative one. It knows it's false. The way I train it is I randomly shuffle those two together. So, and so the neural net doesn't accidentally get into this weird thing where, hey, it's all true, okay, I'm going to change everything to true, and then, oh, it's all false now, so I've got to go all the way back the other way. I shuffle it exactly like a deck of cards. In fact, that's what the routine does. It shuffles it just like a deck of cards. It's something I used for a blackjack program a long time ago. But that's what it does. I assign a value to each one of these, just some random number in front of them, and then it shuffles them. And in fact, I do multiple shuffles to make it really big, make a really big training set. So I check the response, and you can see I did right there. If my response is wrong, then I'm going to do a thing called negative reinforcement, which means if it's wrong, I'm going to slap your knuckles. If it's right, I'm going to ignore what happened. And to do that, what I'll do is to slap your knuckles, I'm going to change the weight on each one of the neural nets in here. So I've got to change this weight's matrix, this one, and this one. I've got three weight's matrices I need to alter in order to store the knowledge that that was right or wrong and store that and now teach the neural net. So it says I use a training function. That's that beta thing that you saw earlier. And I talk a little bit about my training data, my truth data, just like I told you. So as I said, false data is a bunch of random numbers that I use to make fake DNA sequences. Yeah?
Can you verify that the fake data is not contained in does not contain a subset?
Before I used it, yeah. What I did is I ran a, I just did a text match against all of it. Good point. Though the probability of it happening was somewhere on the order of 1 in 50 quadrillion or something like that. It was 10 with a whole bunch of zeros. I actually, I took a slide out. I had a slide that showed you the probability of the random one entering, hitting the real thing. It's really, really small.
Really?
So there is a pattern, but my neural net might not necessarily find it. So, and here's exactly how I created the random number sequence. If you want to go through it, it's in here. That's how I did it. I just created, I used a random 3 function, and then I just used that to decide whether it's going to be an A, D, T, or C, and I created the fake string with that. And then I randomly decided on its width, on its length. It's random data. You train against fake random data. You're trying to find the pattern in the noise. So this is my backward pass. So this is how I alter the first matrix. And you'll see a whole bunch of coefficients in here, and I don't necessarily use them. But I put them here in case I wanted to do it later, and you might want to do the same thing. If you're not getting what you want, you might want to screw with these things. So in my case, just like the example, I use that. I just put some very small number in there. And since my weight matrices are huge, since this particular neural net, one of these instances, had over 1,000 in that first neuron array, then you can imagine if it's 1,000, and the weights matrix is going to be the same size as this, so it's this times this. So you can imagine this is 1,000, this is 300, that means I got 300,000 elements inside the weights matrix. And so, therefore, if I make that number too big, I'm just going to be dividing it back out anyhow. And otherwise, another thing it does if it's too big is it'll mess up your results, and I'll show you how when we get further down. Anyhow, I use this. So I set this number here. This is the part that I'm actually training with. Right now, this is just 1. But you can set it. You can play with it if you want to. You set it to something greater than 1. Correct result minus the wrong result, if it's wrong. And I had a routine that was in 2 slides back that said, hey, if it's right, leave it alone. If it's wrong, we train it. So it goes in here and gets trained with that raw result that we saved before. It alters the weights matrices right here. So this is the part, how much it alters it by the DW matrices in the example. Alters it by that much in the weights matrix. And then I normalize it all so that all my weights add up to 1. And that's all this does right here. I just take the sum of all the weights and divide everything in the weights matrices by that sum. And then it makes everything 1, or a percentage. Goes back through the same backward pass procedure, so now I've altered all my weights inside my neural net, and here's the code that I used to do it in Perl. Again, a series of loops, nested loops. Everybody with me, sort of, so far? I know I'm getting a lot of glazed stares, and I probably lost everybody in the room, and I'm trying not to really bad. I just only know we only got about an hour here, so. The gist is that the nested loops alter every weight in my matrix. All the weights between the first layer and the input of the first layer, between the first layer and the second layer, between the second layer and my one neuron that's at the end that outputs. So it changes all those weights just like in the example. And I do that thousands of times. And it shows the rest of the layers. I'm not going to go through it since that's not really what you probably want to know. So as I said before, here's the trick. So once you've coded your neural net core for pass, back, pass, you have that, you're going to need to run a series of training to alter all your weights matrices so you've trained your neural net to find what you want it to find. The way I did that is you're going to do a series of training iterations across your truth data and fake data. So you're going to take all your fake data, all your real data, shuffle it together into a big pile, and I shuffle it many times to get a 5,000 or so that each training iteration goes against. And then what I do is I run that iteration a few hundred or thousand times, however long my poor computer can handle. And I do that until I get the data I'm after, and I'll tell you how I know that it's finally learned as much as it's going
to
learn.
How long does it take to run those thousands of iterations?
What was it on the Solaris box? It was weeks, if I remember right. It depends on how big your neural net is, though. I used to have a teeny neural net that used to emulate fast bite behavior. So I fed it this, I encoded a bunch of things about a lure. Either a lure or a live piece of bait, right? So if it's a live bait, it should bite it. If it's a lure, it shouldn't bite it, right? I encoded that in a string of maybe 20 input items, right? My input array was 20 plus ones, minus ones. The neural net was 30, one layer of 30 neurons. And then I trained it against 100 things. So I had my deck was 100 and I ran it a few hundred times. That one used to take like 20 minutes to run. But it's a much smaller neural net, so it gets exponentially more painful the bigger it gets.
But now is your freezer well stocked with fish?
No, but I did get an A in that class. That was a neural net class, by the way. So, tabulate the statistics. By the way, that example's on my website. I can actually link out there if somebody wants to code it. It's in QBasic for anybody who cares. As I said, I shuffle it to avoid the dangers of order. And I tabulate statistics on how many times I got it right versus how many times I got it wrong. How do I know? So if I'm running all these training iterations, and I might stop and then run another set, and stop and run another set for ad infinitum, what will happen is eventually my hit rate and miss rate will stabilize at a certain point. So after thousands of iterations or hundreds of iterations, as the case may be, whatever works for your neural net, it will eventually stabilize. If it doesn't stabilize, you haven't run it far enough yet. Or you might have something else wrong that's two slides hence. I'll tell you the one other thing that can do it. So what will happen is I'll run it until my corrects, minuses, misses, and corrects finally stabilize out here somewhere. And what that is my best match, or my stable best match percentage. So that's the best pattern that I can find in this data, and it's going to be something less than 100 unless you've just got the perfect data set. You really have a perfect, easy to find pattern in there. So in the case of like character recognition, that's going to almost be 100%. If you're looking at, you know, R's, A's, you know, things like that. If it's actually typed text, then you're looking, you have something that in a scanner like that matches something out of a typed document you scanned in versus, you know, A through Z. It's going to have a really easy time finding it, so you might actually get pretty close to 100%. Occasionally, it screws up, as you've probably seen, you know, for some of that optical character recognition stuff that you get out of that character recognition stuff. So sometimes it's not 100%, but if it's an easy data set, you can almost get 100%. In my case, I didn't expect it to get anywhere near 100% because it's a hard pattern and it's real life, right? Yeah, I don't have the billions of years to play with it that you know, nature has. So stable best match percentage is the best percentage I find, and I will create an error rate, which is if I match at some level below 100, I'm going to come up with a thing called my neural net error rate, which is 100 minus that stable best percentage match. Instability. So if I'm running my training matrices for a long time, if I made my training iterations for a long time, and I come up with something like this, then I'm training my neural net too hard. So that coefficient that I'm adding against it when I train it, so that either the feather or the iron bar, I'm using an iron bar in this case, and it's not learning. It's just numb from the pain of being beaten. And so it's going to react just like this. It's going to react unstably. It's just going to go, okay, well, you're beating the hell out of me. I'm going to go all the way this way. Next time I run it, oh, you're beating the hell out of me. I'm going to go all the way this way. So it's going to be utterly unstable. So if that happens, you need to lower how hard you're training it. You shrink that coefficient on the training thing, the lambda thing. You shrink that if you see this. If it doesn't ever get to something stable and it keeps going like that, you have two things that could have happened. Either one, you're not training hard enough, you're using a feather. And I'm like, yeah, I feel that, but I'm gonna ignore that's existence. You know, I'm gonna ignore your pokes at me to train. So that's issue best possibility one. The other one is you haven't run long enough. So if it's still improving, you either need to increase the training coefficient, or if you have the time, just let it run longer and see where it ends up. If it's below what you wanted, and this happened to me, but it didn't quite get to this level, so it's better than luck. So what will happen is, let's say I have 10 true things in my training set, and I have 20 fake ones, then by raw chance, 2/3 of the time I'm going to be right, right? So the total of this is 30. So by raw chance, I'm going to be at least 2/3 right, or 66.66% right, just by chance. I could get that way with a coin flip. I could coin flip and I'll be right 2/3 of the time, just because of the fact I have 20 falses and 10 truths. So that's the chance thing. If that happens, that's not good. So either you're not don't have a big enough neural net to find the pattern, or there is no pattern. If you end up above that level, but not as high as you wanted to get, then now you have some room to move. So this means that if it's above the chance level and you've been running it for a long time, there is a pattern there, but it's a weak one. And so now you have to make some decisions. If I started with 100 nodes in my neuron array, I might need to go to 200. So that's one way to try to fix that. Or I might find more true data and then match it with more fake data. So if somehow I can dig up an extra set of true data that might reveal the pattern better to the neural net, I can use that and add that into my training array, and then I'll have to start a new graph. Or I can increase the size of my neural net and try that too.
By increasing the size, you're basically looking at a bigger chunk of data?
No, you're using the same data, but you're increasing how many neurons are trying to learn against it.
Okay.
So if my input array was 300 in this case, right, 300 inputs, my first layer was 600, let's say, and I had this happen, then I increased this now to 700. So I have 700 neurons there where I'm multiplying those 300. I have a weights matrices of 700 by 300 now. And I'm taking all 300 of those inputs and multiplying them into each one of those 700 neurons, multiplying and adding. So I'm using more brain power to find the pattern. By adding neurons, I'm adding brain power. That's exactly what I'm doing. So if there is a pattern, but I can't quite see it good enough, then I need to add more brain power to find the pattern. Another strategy is, and this is the one I wouldn't do unless you have to, is in lieu of making your first layer bigger, you could add another layer behind it to find a more complex pattern. And every layer of neurons you add, it takes a exponentially longer to run, but it also will find an exponentially more complex pattern. Yeah?
How do you know, between layers, whether... Or how do you connect the layers? How is it different having an extra layer than having more neurons in one layer?
You mean, how is it? Okay, well, let's draw this real quick.
What's preferable, basically?
It's preferable to make your layers bigger. Go bigger on your layers before you add another layer, because it adds another matrix that you have to multiply against. That's why it takes exponentially more time. So. I'll say an example. This is again like that example I showed at the first thing where it's the plus and minus, and we showed how it went back around and came in. So input. I'm going to call this my first layer, my first neuron layer. I should have probably illustrated this better. Good lesson learned for next time. So layer two, and then my output layer. Sometimes they call this one my input layer. So what I assume in this neural net, and this is something I should have specified, is that every one of these inputs connects to every neuron in that layer ahead of it. Like this. For every one of these.
Oh, okay. So
Every one of these.
Can you cross all the...
Yeah, every neuron is seeing every input in the first layer. Then every neuron in the second layer is seeing the output of every neuron in the first layer.
And I see this is sequential.
You run this one, so you run this part first, then you run this one. You have to run it sequentially. You cannot parallelize it, no. Good question.
And then you train all the whole net at the same time. You don't do it layer by layer.
You train, you run in the forward pass, you do the whole forward pass at once. So you go all the way until you come up with your output. You run the whole thing down until you get that far. You go all the way up to an end. You have to. You can't stop in the middle.
Yeah, because you don't, between layer one and layer two, you don't know how to evaluate truth.
The only exception is the one thing. So in case of a plus one or minus one, let's say you wanted to make a classifier, and I wanted to stop this here and just come up with a sequence of bits, and I know what that means, then you might do that. I would only do that after I created it, but you know, you could do that. There's actually some useful information right there if you stop it, you know, right after that first layer of neurons, but it may or may not be useful for your particular problem. So normally you go all over. So for training, you always run until you know what you've got. Because you have to know whether it's true or not, or else you can't train. It's like telling a kid 1 + 1 = 2, you know, and then go, well, this time it's 1 + 1 = 3. That's not how it works. You have to know whether it's right or wrong.
How do you decide which what kind of decision makes each neuron? Because if this schematics like it's written, if every neuron in the layer makes the same decisions, then it's no reason to have them.
So the reason it doesn't make the same decision is because of the waste matrix. So what happens, and in here, so it will take this input, let's say it's +1. It'll take the results from the waste matrix, which will be some number less than 1, let's say 10%. And it multiplies this by this to go into this neuron. Down here, that first row is probably not going to be 10%. It's going to be like 12.2%, which comes up with a different result here. So the waste matrix is what stores the knowledge in the neural net.
And the waste matrix is something that is for that established connection.
The weights matrix, yes. Actually, that's how it decides the connection tip.
Okay. Not according to the data, but for that particular connection, to give that weight to the answer, to the final answer.
One more time.
Okay. So each I is connected to N1.
We go back to that first example, because it has a lot better than my pretty crappy handwriting.
Matrix that has a weighting, so that the bottom neuron may have less of a weighting than the top one in the input, correct? And that's what that is.
So each one of these corresponds to a connection, yes. Everything in the weights matrix corresponds to a connection between this layer and the next layer, or this layer and this layer. That's why it's going to be, its size is going to be, in this case, 4 by 2. And this weight matrix is 2 by 1.
So that, I think I just understood what you're saying there. That matrix table is fluctuating according to the training, and then once you get
stabilized,
it stays there.
Just like this.
And that's how you use it to recognize the data.
So when it started, it was all 1.25 across, 0.125 or 1/8, because there's 8 elements in here, and that's how I initialize the weights matrix. So 1 divided by 8 is 1.125. Mm-hmm. So that's how I started. And after I trained it once, it lowered the weights over here on the end for that correspond to these two. So these two inputs, so this line here and this line here, now get less. And the same with this line and this line. So the weights matrix corresponds to every one of these connectors in here. So I've weakened the ones that feed that -1 in, and I've strengthened the ones that feed the +1 in.
And this matrix...
So that's the point. Now it's 0.14 instead of 0.125.
Yeah, what I'm saying, though, is that matrix is something that you work on.
That's what the training does.
When you're finished with the training, you use that set matrix to to then search for the...
That's exactly what you use it for. So now when you're done, your pattern is stored in those weight matrices, and that's why you have to save it. Because that's the product of your work. And now with that trained weights matrix, you use the same neural net, except you only go forward to find what you're trying to find. Because you're not training it anymore. You don't need to go back and run a training pass on it. You just need to keep going forward passes. Because now it knows what it's looking for. So it'll tell you then whether it is or is not what you're trying to find. So if it were an R and it had an extra loop in it, then it would come back with a minus one because it knows better. It won't find a 6 for your R. It'll just find the R. And then the character recognition example. Because now it knows better. That was the result of your training, is all those weights matrices stored all that knowledge. So when you're done, your weights matrices won't be 1 divided by however many elements are in here. It'll be a whole bunch of different numbers in there. And something that indicates that really well, by the way, is the fact it compresses really well with the zip. So if you do zip on the weights matrix when you want to save it, just because it's huge, then you can do a zip on it and it'll compress to something really small.
So could we digress for half a second just to talk about an example I'm sure most of us can more readily grasp, OCR.
Optical character recognition, yeah.
Yeah, let's just talk about alphas for a second. You've got 52 alphas, uppercase, lowercase.
Yeah.
How many weight matrices do you have?
However many you wanted to have. What would I do?
Yeah.
So if I had 26 characters in the alphabet.
This is what I would do in that case.
So I need to make a bitmap of how many, for each character, I'm going to decide how big of an area I'm looking at for the pattern. Let's say it takes 10 bits to make the R and 10 bits to make that, 10 bits each direction, right?
Right.
10 by 10, 100 bits total to make whatever pattern that has the R in it. Right, so in this case, that's 100 items in my input array. They're all minus ones and plus ones in this case because I wouldn't mess with the zeros.
So each one is like a pixel.
Each one would be a pixel, literally. If it's black and white, yes, literally. Quite literally, it's just a pixel.
Or you want a black and white to increase your chance of recognition?
For this case, yes. So black and white would be 100 by 100. And then what I would start with is I'd probably start with 1 layer neural net because I know that this is probably going to come out pretty well. Because if there's a 100% chance that that's not an R.
Right.
The pattern is much easier to find at something like this. That's just the way the problem set is. I mean, we all know it because our computers all do it all the time. And so, for this, let's say we use upper and lower case. What is that?
52.
All the numbers?
They're in the digits.
62.
Okay.
Punctuation.
Let's say we have 100 characters I want to find. I would make sure I had a random down here of at least 200 just random things. Random dots inside that 100, that 10 by 10 dip. Now the downside is, yes, you're going to probably have a chance of collision, so I would use a neural net that's really good at looking at this, your eye, to make sure that it's not what you're trying to accidentally find. So I'd have 100 by 100, 100 trues, 200 false. These guys come up with a minus one. These guys get a plus one. My neural array here, since I have, let's say, what did I decide, 100 in my input array?
Yeah.
I would start with this being 200, which means my weights matrix that's going to be between these two is going to be 200 by 100 in size. And then the first value that's in the whole weights matrix is all going to be starting off the same way. So it's going to be, each value to start with is going to be 1 over 200 times 100. That's the first value that's going to appear in the weights matrices all start with that, for this weights matrix. And I'm going to start with just one line. So since I'm coming out to a plus one or minus one, because I know if it's a character, it's going to be a plus one.
It's not a character, it's going to be a minus one, right? I've got to send this whole thing into one big thing so I can get a plus one or minus one output. This weight's matrix, so this is 200 by 1. And its value is going to start with 1 over 200 for everything in that weight's matrix. So I'm going to call this one WI and this one WO. Weights in, weights out. The thing you're going to find out when you run this is this one's not going to change. It's actually going to stay probably about the same. It's a good guess. Just because really all you're doing is taking this whole thing and just sticking it in one neuron. It could change, but chances are it probably won't. This one is going to be where all the magic changing is going to happen. And all these weights matrices between this input, the input that comes directly from your R that you run through your input encoder to make it all plus ones and minus ones for each one of these little pixels. And the first layer of neurons, this N high. That's where the magic's going to occur when you run it.
So after you train it, then you've got a weight matrix set up that will reliably recognize
You store these two.
Right.
And then the code you use to make this happen, which you're going to have a nested loop right here to do your forward pass, is going to be the IJ. I could use an IJ. And that loop is going to run for every one of these. It's going to run against all of these. Right. And that's how it goes through your weights matrix. It goes like this. Works its way down your matrix.
So then you would have theoretically 100.
It's a big 2D array.
Yeah.
So take the word matrix out, just 2D array.
So the question is then you'd have theoretically 100 different weight matrices, one for each letter.
If you wanted to come out to, if you just wanted to find out whether it's a letter or not, you'd have one. If you wanted to find out if it's a particular letter,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
Then you would have 100 matrices to figure it out, or, and here's the other trick you could do, you take this output and say, if this happens, then it's an R. And if you could work backwards and figure out what that's going to be. But that's implying that you know a lot about what's going on inside your array. So you could actually train this whole thing just to figure out whether it's a character, and if you were really slick, and you stored these, you could actually compare to say, well, it was right every time. No, by the way, when it was right, all these plus all these values right here indicate an R. So you could actually do it with one neural net and one set of weights. If you're really good about storing all these data, for not just for R, for the whole alphabet. But ideally, you would do what you said. The best way to do it would be to use a weights matrix for every character. That if you wanted to come up with the output of every character.
Which is pretty darn inefficient.
That would be the inefficient way. The efficient way would be doing just what I just said, which is probably what happens. If I'm guessing the way somebody does this, what they did is they trained it to make sure it could find characters. So now I know if I have a character and I store this data right here before I add it into this thing, so before I do the big sum, and before I apply my sine function, I've got a bunch of values for this result, which is the n, what is it, ni times that wo. I could store all of those and use that to figure out that if I see this array of those multiplying numbers and they're all going to be something less than a 1, they're going to be some huge set of percentages, essentially. I could use that to map against these. And so I could cheat and use just one neural net to do it. If this is the right size.
And then you loop it with a different weight table until it gets a match.
No, you could use the same weight table.
I would say you can end up with, if you code your letters with 4 bits, which is 128 letters, and all you need is 4 output neurons, and then you train your medium matrix.
Same result. That's correct. That's the alternative way of doing
it.
Yes, it stopped right here at 4. And then you'd have this thing being 200 by 4. And you'd end up with 4 bits as a result.
That's your function.
That's good. He gets it.
269.
I just always chop everything to 1 and 0 just because that was the problem set I was after. But he's right. If you know how many bits and you have a mapping of bits to letters, to encode your letters, then you can do exactly what he said. Instead of an output array of 1, you have an output of 4. And it'll come up with 4 bits as a result. And if you say those 4 bits come up with a letter, then I'm good. They come up with something that's not a letter, then it's false, train. You could also do that to make sure it comes up to the right letter.
Which would be another step over what you've got there.
Well, that's actually, but that's, you could, you, it's the same training set. It's just in how you train it. So it's over here, how you're telling it whether it's right or wrong. Since now I have 4 bits, like he says, if I, let's say I hit his 4-bit case, I'm going to come up with something like this. And I have to know that this is an R. Now, if this comes up with an S, that's wrong in his 4-neuron case. If it comes up with, it's not a character, it's still wrong. So if this comes up and matches no character, then it's still wrong. So these are both wrong. This is the one right that Femmer, in this case. That's how you train. So if it doesn't match it perfectly, wrong. Train it. Until it does this, which means you're going to need a more complex one of these. You probably need a larger array than 200 then. So 200 will just tell you if it's character or not. More than 200 will probably tell you which character it is. And in this case, 200 going into 4 will tell you which particular character you can train against, which character it is, and how you can train. It's all in how you slice it.
So you're looking for a pattern.
I mean, you could do what he said and just use 53, however many he said. What'd you say, 56 weights matrices? You could do that, and that's a valid answer. Then you would train just looking for one character against random. Right? Or you could train it against looking one character in a much more complex thing and say, okay, I found null and all the characters. Okay, now I've got to figure out which character it is, which is another problem. Then I have to do something weird to get to that particular character. Or you can come into like 4 and encode them all, and then if it's not exactly what I wanted, it's wrong. There's a lot of ways you can do this.
Now, if you're doing this, this is for a well-formatted character.
Well, you would know this is the right.
I'm sorry, what?
You would know this is the right character. You have to have something you know is right and something you know is wrong. Let's say you wanted to go even further and start going, okay, if it's this fuzzy thing, but I know it's an R, then it's still an R. It actually should already figure that out. That's what the neural net does. It doesn't look for an exact match. But if there's always an exact match, then you wouldn't need a neural net. You just use a character match. Right? You just run through it and say, okay, if these bits add up off this thing, if bit 100 is in this place and it's black, all the way to bit, 100 by, or, 9 by 10, and it's black, then it's an R. That's an exact match. What the neural net will do is it'll take it against this noise, and if it looks like this, couple random dots, it knows that's an R. That's the magic of the neural net.
Yeah, that's what else.
That's what it does. So that's the thing he illustrated as one way to train it. As you would stop with 4 neurons here, and then you take the encoding, and if it matches it exactly to what you were after, it's right, everything else is wrong, train it. Everything else is wrong, change the weight matrices and run it again. Pretty complex topic for an hour, I realize.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You can teach an entire course on this.
Well, they do.
Huh?
I'm sure they do.
I know. I took one about 13 years ago. And it existed before that. Neural nets have been around for a long time. As I said, since they replicate biology, they've been around since the 20s. Mathematically, they've been around since at least the 1900s.
Do some of the newer languages lend themselves to more elegant solutions for programming?
For programming this, other than that, there are some tricks you can do with the matrices. So if you know your data is of a certain type, you end up with a thing called a striped matrix. And if you know how to multiply striped matrices, you can actually shrink how long it takes for each one of these, each layer result to occur. So there is a trick. There's also things called upper triangular matrices that emerge in some cases, and you can use that trick.
Just that he has a sort of path to use a triangle.
Or just a stripe in some cases.
Okay.
So then you get into the matrix math that goes with this, and I'm trying to stay away. I'm trying to stay out of that, but yes, that happens. If you go to that Haken book, he's all Oedipal nets. I think his examples are about his Fortran, too, if I'm not mistaken, but
Fortran and Perl are two of the more positive things for doing this.
Yeah, the reason I use Perl is because of the text chunking that happens regularly through this whole process. Because I got to take the XML, feed it in, well, there's a nice pretty Perl thing to do that. And then I take the AGTCs and swap them out for a bunch of plus ones, minus ones. Well, Perl's really good at that, because it'll just use a bunch of splits and a bunch of replaces, right? So that's the reason I went to Perl for this. If you really wanted it to run fast, you take the forward pass and the backward pass, and you code it in like C, which is probably a little faster. You know, or you might even drop it into something fully compiled, leave it compiled, and just use it as a compiled routine. So that's a couple other tricks that can help you along here, but that's how I do your optical character recognition. The other one I'm looking at, the one I'm looking at for somebody else, is a plankton thing. So he looks at plankton inside of your inside of the ocean, and plankton looks like this, I guess. And it might be of different sizes, so it might be closer to the sensor or further away from the sensor. So my problem is making it all a uniform size right off the bat. And then finding this shape of plankton, and oh, by the way, it might be facing me. Or it might be turned the other way. And having it determine which species of plankton. Using about a 2 or 3 layer neural net to start with, I'll see where it goes from there. Doing something like this, probably take X bits by X bits. Just sort of like that right there. So it's a big, wide, huge topic, and I'm as I said, I'm sorry it's hard to squeeze into an hour, but I tried my darndest. Thank you, thank you. And if you want to look in here, you can see how I took the XML and played with it too, by the way. So it's in the back of this thing, and I'm not going to go into it since... The one thing I wanted to touch before we walk out of here is the error rate thing. Because remember I said before, the more you train it, the more accurate it is. Here's what happens if you don't. So if I get less than 100, say I get 90%, and I'm scanning 1,000,000 bases of DNA, 1 e to the 6, 1 minus that's 10% of 1,000,000, which is 100,000. So I'm going to have at least 100,000 times it's going to be wrong out of that 1,000,000, out of the times I run that neural net, because I only got the 90%. My case, I only got to 86. And as I said, it runs a week. So doing what I can. Anything else in here? My email's up in the front. And I'm going to post this whole presentation. Actually, it's already posted, right?
It's already posted.
Feel free to pull it up. I'm going to try to send in a code snippet so that you can get a better forward pass if anybody wants to monkey with it. Thank you. Right. Sorry it took you too. Sorry we went over, by the way. Yeah, it's just a very complex topic. Yeah. Now, some other times, if the other guy's done the first bioinformatics, if you ever want me to do another one of those, if he does, I'm sure he covered all this stuff, but if there's some other weird bioinformatics topic, I can cover that sometime, too, if you guys get an inkling.
I have questions. Is there anyone whose brain is not burning right now? Good job.